This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 182. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
0208 816 7691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Welcome along, Garris. How's it going?
Yeah, very good. Very good, thank you. Yeah, I had a very good week. We've had Brian Ashton, ex-England rugby coach, who happens to be one of my mentors as well, coaching mentors, which is good. He was in school this week working with our rugby players, but also did a coach development workshop. Brian coached, he was one of the assistant coaches when England won the World Cup in 2003 and took England to a World Cup final in 2007. So knows his onions, that man, and he's a great bloke to have around, so that's good. And then we had Gordon Lord, who's the elite coach education manager for the ECB, come in and run a session for the coaches on Friday. So it was a coach development over, which is fantastic.
Oh, so you've had some big brains to pick in these last few days.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had not just cricket, but also we had our other coaching staff in, and it's been a really interesting week. And the thought and the words and the talk that's going around the school is fantastic at the moment. And we're implementing quite a lot of the things that both of the guys suggested.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I think with not just with cricket, but with a lot of sports, they can be very insular. They can be within their own worlds and not really take in the thoughts and ideas of other sports, even though people are still people. It doesn't matter what shape or size the ball is.
Exactly right. And the great thing when you listen to both of them is that both of them now do some consultancy in other sports, and both of them research other sports massively, and it's the transferability of their messages. So Brian Ashton talked about Muhammad Ali a lot. He talked about Michael Jordan a lot and related it back into rugby and then related it into other sports. Because we've worked together quite a lot. He was asking me questions about England setups and in our forums. So he was asking me questions rather than always asking him the questions. And the same with Gordon Lord. He's had example, worked within the Tour de France teams and works within squash, and obviously has played a huge role in the development of coach education and cricketers within England as well. Does a lot of stuff in business too, and it's the transferability of messages, because ultimately high performance is high performance irrespective of the ball or even the industry that you're in.
Yeah, it's a horrible phrase, but it kind of sums things up nicely when you say thinking outside the box, because especially with a sport like cricket, which has got a lot of traditions within it, you're always sort of tied to those traditions, and unless you bring someone in from the outside, then you're often going to overlook things that you take for granted. But that person says, well, hang on a minute, that's not how we do it here, and maybe you should try doing it in this way, and maybe that'll work for you. And sometimes you can go even broader and further afield. I mean, I've had ideas for coaching things and for articles and stuff like that from just reading a novel, which has got nothing to do with cricket. But then there's just some word or phrase or turn of phrase or idea or concept that makes you think, I wonder if that would apply within the context of cricket as well as it applies within whatever context you're reading it in. So I think it's really important, isn't it, to be as broadly read and as broadly educated as you can be, as well as being highly specialised.
I completely agree. And we always talk about the most effective people are the ones with the broadest resources that they can draw upon. And I think that's exactly the same within cricket as it is within any industry that anybody works in that might be listening to this show.
And of course, thinking about going back to the cricket side of things, we've seen the climax of the World 2020, and a lot of teams have gone out in the Super 8 stages, including India. But one of the big talking points for while India was still in the T20 was a selection dilemma, and I think it's one that a lot of sides have from the very highest level all the way down to even down to sort of the under 11s in a academy or a club side, in that you have to have five bowlers in 2020 cricket, but India very specifically only picked four, and then had fill-in bowlers for the rest of it. So that's an interesting tactical discussion that I think probably happens all over the place. What's your view on the idea of having fill-in bowlers if you need that fifth bowler?
Well, I've seen it work both ways. And at Somerset in 2005, we had fill-in bowlers. So Wes Durston, Graham Smith, and Aral Sapaia would make up our fifth bowler in various guises, depending on the situation, the pitches that he was batting at the time, and a bit of a feel at the time of what we should go with. And we had success with four bowlers and a fill-in guy, or a combination of fill-in guys. So that worked. But England, when they won the previous World Cup, were very, very clear that they wanted five out-and-out bowlers, and really Paul Collingwood would only bowl one over at max if needed to, as a bit of a what-if plan. And they went very specifically with that. And it's been interesting listening to Colly talking on commentary and the summary stuff that he's been doing with Sky. And he's been constantly talking about the importance of having five bowlers rather than the four, because, ultimately in 20 overs, your top six batters should be doing the majority of the run scoring, really. So if a wicketkeeper, which we inevitably see within T20, is in that top six. Very rarely in T20 do you have a wicketkeeper that sits outside that top six. Obviously, that leaves five bowling options. So that was England's message when they won it in 2007, and it worked successfully for them. But also, it's about what you've got, and with Somerset in 2005, that's what we had. And we had people making it up, but doing it with skill and very, very well planned, and executing it as well as they possibly could.
I mean, if you've got four absolute crackerjack bowlers, and you know that none of them can bat, then or particular bat particularly well, then yeah, maybe you do want that insurance policy at number seven, and try and fill in as best you can in that situation, especially if your fill-in bowlers are quite decent bowlers. Someone like Yuvraj, for example, is not a bad fill-in bowler to have, especially in 2020. What would
Oh,
you,
absolutely.
yeah, what I mean, what would you have done if you were selecting the Indian side, though? Which way would you have gone with the resources that they had, the players that they had?
I don't know is the answer to that. I know which way they were always going to go, and the combination of Mahinder Singh Dhoni and Duncan Fletcher were always going to go with loading the batting as much as they possibly can, because that's very much Fletcher's style. It was very much Fletcher's style when I worked with him. And it was evident that England during the time, even in test matches, would generally go in with four bowlers. And then maybe somebody to do some make-up overs. England are now doing it with Flower. I think it's the mentality of those coaches is very much to make sure that the batting gives yourself a chance of being successful. I would say that in a country of as many cricketers as that, I'd be disappointed if you couldn't find a backup bowler, somebody of quality of Yuvraj, and somebody else maybe who's at higher quality. And I think that's probably where they got let down a little bit, in that Yuvraj can do that role. He's obviously been out of the game for a little while with his health issues, but it's then the backup of people like Kohli and those guys which probably let them down a little bit. As a bowling unit, but ultimately, their batting didn't really fire as well as it should have done in the competition. So if they'd have batted well enough, then I'm sure that the four bowlers would have been sufficient.
Yeah, and it's still, even though the skills of bowling have improved so much since 2020 first started, and it has become I think the balance is a bit less towards the batsman. It is still a game that where if your batting fires, then you'll win more often than you don't.
Yeah, definitely, and we've seen that in this tournament, haven't we? That lots of teams have got 170, 180, haven't they? 165 to 180 has been a pretty good score, and very rarely have those guys lost the game. So it is about getting those runs on the board. It's about your batters putting yourself in a position, whether you're batting first and setting a target, or whether you're not. So I can see the logic behind the way that India went in. I thought it was a viable one. They probably got undone in the bowling stakes by Yuvraj just not having done enough bowling, because he's obviously had his health issues to get over. And Kohli is an all right bowler, but you certainly don't want him to be bowling 12 balls in a 2020 game unless the conditions are absolutely suited to him, which they haven't been.
Yeah, so there's definitely food for thought, especially for those selectors who have a group of players from which to choose, and they want to, and it's the last cup position or the last couple of positions that always causes the problem in all situations, isn't it? And I guess that's what
Absolutely.
we're talking about here.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's wrap up this little section with our usual yes/no round. And of course, every week there is three questions which the panel can only answer yes or no to. And as well as that, you can answer yes or no to them by logging on to pitchfishing.com/academy and clicking on the yes or no options from the link that's in the sidebar there. So, Berners, you've got the questions there. Fire away.
First question, unstructured development leads to mystery spinners.
Yes.
Yes. And 50% of the audience agreed with us there, and 50% said no, so it was split.
Second question, points of technique are always negotiable.
Cool, that's a great question. Yes.
Yes. And 75% of the audience agreed with us and said yes to that one.
Third question, coaching is more art than science.
Yes.
Yes. And again, 75% of the audience lean towards the art side of coaching, with only 25% saying no. Let's rummage around in the mailbag again this week and see what kind of questions we've had sent in this week. Because every week you can send in your questions to the show, and the best two questions are read out, and the best one of those questions gets a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Berners, you've got the two questions this week. Fire away.
First question comes in from AB. How long do you think it will be until the rate of innovation in T20 tactics finally slows down? It's been 10 years now, and we're still seeing new ideas emerging every tournament. New shots, new variations, new field settings, new batting plans, new bowling rotations. It seems like the way to win at T20 is to be one step ahead of the field in terms of an innovative and unexpected strategy. In comparison to longer formats, there is so little time for adjustment out on the field that if you come up with something the opposition weren't expecting, you immediately gain a significant and often decisive advantage. If you can come up with a completely new tactic, opposition's teams will eventually find a way to adjust. By the time they do, the tournament may be over. Let's discuss, guys.
It's a really good question, actually. I like it, and I think he's looked at all the different aspects of it really well. In terms of the first bit, how long do you think it will be before the rate of innovation slows? I'd say it probably won't slow, and the reason why, and particularly at World Cups, that it won't slow is that the World Cups are played at different venues every 2 years. So every 2 years, as much as the game is the game, you have to factor in some skills, and the skills that have been shown in this T20 have been a little bit venue specific, more so than, or in a different way to the T20 was in the West Indies 2 years ago. And when England won it in 2010, they played their last couple of matches on a very bouncy wicket in Barbados. So obviously the tactics were very different in that World Cup than they have been in this particular version. Whereas at the beginning of the tournament, they played their cricket, as did Ireland, who I was with at the time, in Guyana, which required a bit more of a subcontinent approach to it. So, the wickets do have a, and the conditions do have an impact. So you'll never see the same ones all of the time, because the next time the World Cup's going to be in a different place again, and you have to factor that in. The answer, I'm not really probably going to give you an answer to this next bit about innovation and what have you. There are new variations, and it's important to stay ahead of the curve with innovations. But I also believe that it's putting those innovations and mixing those in with bog standard skill execution. And you look at Chris Gayle, who's the most prolific batter in T20 cricket, and again proved it yesterday in that super over. And actually, he's not innovated at all in his game over the last few years, in the same way as Malinga really hasn't innovated his game massively in the last 4 years. He's just mastered it a bit more. So executing your base skills is going to be massive in any competition, wherever it is in the world, you know, and whatever format you're playing in, because your skills are massive. It's then how you mix in innovation on the top of it to keep the opposition guessing. So, you know, Malinga's still going to be blimmin' competitive in this World Cup because he's going to nail his Yorker. He's got a fantastic slower ball. He's got a good bumper and he's got a good slower ball bumper. He had those 3 years ago. He's probably better at executing now than he was back there. So that's not innovation. That's just him executing his skills. Gale's probably going to give West Indies the best chance of winning this tournament, and he's going to play the same shots as he always has done, but his execution has got better and better over the years. Then you'll have people that will put some innovation in on top of that. And it's a combination of that, those base skills, delivering your skills under high pressure as best you possibly can, which Gale did yesterday and Southie didn't, for an example. And then putting the innovation on top of that, the innovation being the icing on the cake rather than the cake that sits beneath it. That's my view.
Yeah, innovation is an interesting thing because very often when something new happens in a tournament like the World 2020, everyone says, well, this is a brilliant innovation. But then you look at it, you go back, you trace it back, and whatever it is, has probably happened before. It's just that nobody was expecting it to happen in that tournament because maybe it's a skill that had been forgotten about or, you know, has died away, or, you know, there's very few truly unique things that no one's ever come up with before. And I think that's probably the skill of innovation, is that someone who can put together two ideas which maybe weren't put together before and come up with this concept that catches everybody by surprise. And it is the surprise element that catches people out, as AB said in his question. It's the surprise element of, say, somebody like Mendes, who when he first burst on the scene was this new mystery spinner who was unplayable. Then everybody kind of worked him out and he lost his effectiveness for a while, so, and then he had to come back with something else, some other way to execute his skills that was that would overcome the batsman. So I think when I look at innovation and the rate of innovation, I think to myself, I don't think it's new things that people are coming up with. I think it's just rethinking old things and putting different ideas together to come up with new ways of looking at the same information, because there really isn't anything new under the sun. And what's interesting about it is that it's the rate of innovation in these kind of games is also having effect on one of the oldest sports, which is Test cricket. In that the rate of innovation in Test cricket has probably never been more frantic either. And that's a game that's been going on for hundreds of years.
I'm a huge believer that the transferability from format to format is impacting on things, and fielding being the biggest example of that to me. You know, it wasn't long ago that, and I remember watching Test matches on the television with Peter West commentating and introducing the show, where if the ball went one foot wide of the bloke standing at mid-off, he'd either put a foot out or just wait for one of the crowd to chuck it back again. And you know, since 2003, when T20 cricket was first played in England, the fielding standards have gone through the roof. And I think, you know, that's only one example. But the bowling variations have come in. You see people bowling cross seam in Test matches on certain pitch conditions. That would never have happened years ago. You see people bowling slower balls in Test matches. You know, nobody bowled a slower ball. There'll be some Test matches that would go on, and maybe Test series that would go on 20 years ago, where everybody bowled the ball at their optimal pace all of the time. So those sort of things have come about as the shorter formats of the game have started to impact upon the longer one. And to me, it makes it an even more exciting game. Test match cricket now, I really want to see crowds come back around the world, because I think it's incredibly interesting, Test match cricket now. And certainly more interesting than I remember back in the 80s, where you had one very, very dominant side who would just steamroller everybody. I think we've got a lot of equally talented sides in world cricket now, which makes it very interesting, and also the innovations and the tactics and the techniques make the game a very positive one to play, rather than what was happening in the 80s, which was about survival when you batted It's still about 20 wickets. You can, you know, you invariably need to get 20 wickets to win a test match. But it's the pace of the runs per over and the pace of the game which makes it a really attractive one for me anyway.
Next question comes in from Angus, and he's loving what we're doing. He's just got a question regarding one of the coaching bulletins, and this refers to batsmen. And he's just saying that currently he's noticed a lot of batsmen standing quite far back in their crease. And he's saying it used to be that the back foot would be just inside the crease line, or some batsmen would stand completely out for pace bowlers to negate swing and obviously move a little bit closer to the ball. Now the front foot is just outside the crease and the back foot is almost on the stump. So the batsmen are standing, you know, really deep into their crease. And he's just wondering, is this to give them more time? Is it to combat maybe reverse swing? Is it as important as using the feet to spinners? And he's just saying, what should club cricketers do faced with the nightmare LBW decisions and no DRS? Also, do batsmen have much wider stances now? And if so, why is that? So just generally, why everyone's at the top of the game seems to be standing a lot further back in the crease. So what do you think, fellas?
Give us your view from the elite level, Gareth.
So I think the difference at the elite level of the game is that people really understand their preference for movement and preference for how they play. So somebody like Jonathan Trott, he would definitely be somebody who wants to bat with his front foot on the crease more, to watch the ball as long as possible, let the ball do what it's going to do before he makes contact with on a regular basis. But somebody like Kevin Peterson would take the ball early, and we see that in those side-on Hawkeye images, don't we, where people are making contact with the ball. There's no right or wrong. They're just working with their preference and using their skills most applicably. So there isn't a move to get people to stand behind the crease in coaching terms. It's purely when you get to that level is that players are very, very secure and very sure about the way that they need to go about thing and the way that they need to go about managing their own bodies and their own innings. And it's not really a move away from doing the things that we used to do. It's just that those guys have worked out what works best for them. Now, how does that relate back into the club game? Well, I don't think it teaches us anything about whether people should stand back or not, but it might give a player the opportunity to experiment whether that tactic or that strategy works well with their bodies and with the way that they play the game. Certainly, if I think back to myself, I used to stand outside of my crease when I batted, yet was predominantly a back foot player. So in review, I would probably shift my stance nowadays if I was to be 19 now, but know what I know at the age of 430. I'd probably take a little bit back and use the length of the pitch and use the bounce of the ball to actually access more attacking shots for myself. But that's just, you know, me knowing more about myself now than I did when I was actually playing the game and earning my living out of it. But at the top level, that's what those guys do. But it's no harm for us to try some of the things that we see on telly and see whether they work for us, because unless we try them, we won't actually know.
Yeah. Would you say that potentially one of the reasons could be that in the 2020 format, when you're trying to get under the ball and get it over the infield, sometimes it's easier to readjust yourself with more time further back?
Certainly at the back end of the innings, you know when somebody's going to go Yorkers and that's their predominant. So yesterday, for example, you know, Southey had one option, didn't he was to go Yorkers, and that's where he bodged it up, to be perfectly honest, because there was no deception about what he was doing and he put a lot of pressure on his execution. So you know, the two West Indies guys knew that he was going to go Yorkers because that's what he always does, and they were able to set themselves, and they set themselves slightly further back in the crease and then loaded forward and hit two massive sixes off of ill-directed balls. So yes, that's definitely a tactic that is used. So that would be a coaching thing that's used when you're looking to hit, particularly when somebody's looking to go Yorker. But that often comes at a very small time of a game, you know, or a very finite time of a game. Again, that's something that can be practiced in nets. We've talked about it with backloading in some of the articles that I've put together. So, you know, unless you try those as a club cricketer, you're not going to know whether they work for you.
For me, I think it's that there's a lot more options available now. There's a lot more people doing a lot of different things compared to 20 years ago. And people see that and then start to think, well, I wonder if I should do it. And I think the key to it is, if you know what your options are, and then you're quite mindful of the reasons why you're going to experiment with a change, rather than thinking, oh, well, I've seen Jonathan Trott do it, I'm just going to try it on Saturday afternoon now, then that's probably not the best way to go about it. But if you think to yourself, well, you know, here's the reasons for trying it. I'm going to give it a go in the nets, see what happens. And if it's successful in the nets, you know, maybe I'll take it out into the middle, or maybe I'll abandon it and try something else. But I think the key to it is to do it in a mindful way. Be aware of what you're doing, and don't be blithely just copying someone you admire just because of the way that he stands, you know, with a very wide stance, like say Kevin Peterson does, it wasn't that long ago when, you know, feet very close together was very common as a stance, and you hardly ever see that now. So it's slightly about making sure that you're not just following a trend for the sake of following a trend, and you're thinking about the reasons why you're doing it. And I think that will stand you in good stead, whatever the particular technique is, whether it's standing out of your crease, standing way back in your crease, or whatever. In terms of actually standing in your crease, I think it's quite a nice tactic in the club game, because you get wicketkeepers who are standing up to medium paces quite a lot. So it's a lot harder if you've got a medium pacer on who's swinging the ball around, and you want to negate the swing by standing out of your crease. You have to be pretty confident to do that with a wicketkeeper standing up. So it might be a nice thing to try if there's a bowling swing and you want to just mess up his length a little bit by standing a little bit further in the crease. It's probably worth a try. You ever tried that, Berners, changing your crease position?
I think I do it without noticing. Like, I wouldn't say consciously I've thought about doing something. I mean, normally if things aren't going my way and I'm struggling against a bowler, like, you know, he's bowling a very consistent line outside off stump, then you might just shuffle back or forward. Or, to be honest, my thinking behind it's never really, I would say, logical. I'm just trying to literally create something and give myself a different platform to see if I can literally hit the ball sometimes. But I've quite often get stumped as well against the spinners, so I tend to play from deeper into the crease, just so psychologically I'm always got something behind the actual crease line, if that makes sense. I can't say I've ever done it for a logical reason and thought it through.
So when you get stumped, right, is it because you're coming down the wicket at spin?
I'm coming down the wicket and I go too early and I neglect the line of the ball. So as soon as it goes up, I'm off. Yeah.
Let me try to apply some logic and some change your conventional thinking on that. If you're standing further back in the crease because you get stumped, right, and you're saying that you go too early, one of the reasons why you're going too early is because the distance between your starting position and where you need to get to is too big. So Mark Waugh would say when he was looking to go down the pitch, he would actually stand with his foot on the crease line because he knew he was going to go down the pitch at somebody, which would then reduce the distance, which means he could go later to deceive the bowler.
Right. Yeah, I like that.
How does that sound?
No, that's very, very logical. And I guess that's half my problem. If I'm, say, taking three steps when I could take half a step or one step and crash it on the half volley, I'm probably still striving to get there as the ball's pitching. But if I had that extra yard or so on me when I was leaving, then yeah, that would make sense. But going down the line of the ball is a big thing as well, I find. The number of times I'm nowhere near it, head, body, hands. Yeah. And I've done it for quite a few years. It's quite funny at the end of the season, you see a ways out. I mean, I've got about 1 year, 70% of my dismissals were stumped.
Which is massive, mate, because normally people are under 10% in the times that they get stumped.
Yeah. And that's me throwing my wicket away, really, isn't it? It's a very cheap way to get out, getting stumped. I like that. I'll take that forward, that thinking. And again, I've never, I mean, tried different things with just anchoring the foot and actually just saying to myself subconsciously, look, play this guy off the back foot to start with. No matter where it lands, I got to the stage where no matter where it lands, I'm going on the back foot. And I'm just going to look to nick and nurdle him and then try to like almost play myself in again once the spinner comes on, rather than going hell for leather from the off and looking to take him out.
Yeah, no, give it a go. I mean, there's loads of things from what you've just said that you could explore, and that could be another one for another show, mate.
Cheers, Gareth.
All All right, so it's time for the soapbox. Every week, somebody gets 60 seconds to rant and rave about just about anything they want. And this week, Gareth is climbing up on the soapbox. So, over to you.
I'm going to talk to you about a coach experience I had this week, actually. And I went to go and watch somebody who I've coached as a bowler, but he was batting the other day. And but this lad had had some exposure to a guy who played Test cricket, actually, who has done some good coaching in his own time. This lad was 6'5" and is a tall guy. And the advice that he was given is that no batters, tall batters, crouch down have been successful. So they've got to stand up really tall when they bat and get their head into the ball. And I watched this guy bat for a bit and he looked fixed. So I did a couple of little tests on him, which we might allude to at some stage in the future. And actually his preference was to sit back into his stance and almost sit on his heels, very much like a Kevin Peterson, and go from a low position in his drive. And he planned that he could move forward, and he called himself a punchy crab at the end of his session as opposed to a lanky giraffe.
Okay, we're just about finished for this week, but we're going to wrap up the show with the competition winner for this week, and of course the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So there was a couple of questions this week, good ones. Gareth, which one did you prefer?
Well, I actually thought these were two of our best ones. And I know I say that every week, but I think our questions are getting better, which is fantastic. And congratulations to both AB and Angus on really stretching this, which is what it's all about. I think that both were really valid. I'm going to give it to AB's this purely, pretty much, because we're in that World 2020 and coming to the end of that World 2020. And probably by the time some of you listen to this, we know the winners of it. So because it's a current flavour, AB wins it this week.
Okay, congratulations to you. And if you want to send in your own question, you're listening to this and you think, I fancy an online coaching course, I fancy going on to Pitch Vision Academy and getting some videos from Kevin Peterson or JP Duminy, then you can do that by sending in your question. And Berners, how would somebody do that?
They can give us a call, 02088 167 691, or drop us an email, coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, you can also send us a very short message on Twitter at PB Cricket Coach, or you can head over to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Pitch Vision Academy, and leave a question there if you prefer the Facebook. If you want to listen to the show every week, you can subscribe in iTunes. Just open up iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us there. Click on the subscribe button to get the show every week down onto your iPod, your iPad, your iPhone, whatever you've got. Or if you don't want to do that and you still want to subscribe, then head over to pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link and you've got all the details for how to subscribe to the show using whatever clever device that you use. So we've got a tail ender this week. It was submitted on our Facebook page, and it was from Ben James. Thank you for your contribution, Ben. And the tail ender this week is a ferret. Have you ever come across this one before, Berners?
I've met loads of ferrets, but I don't know if, not in cricketing terms, I'm intrigued.
It's the batsman who is even worse than the bunny. It's the one that goes in after the rabbit.
Ferrets.
Yeah, we've seen a couple of those in our times in club cricket, I bet, Berners.
I would say that most of our ferrets go in after the number one and two, to be honest. But
yeah, that's a bit harsh, but considering the season my team had last year as well, I think I probably agree with you. That's all for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Berners.
Cheers, guys. Have a good week.